Sequence is loading.
You want to bone me up?
I beg your pardon?
From a testimony. Shouldn't you prep me?
Ready, ready, ready.
Relax.
Breathe. Enjoy.
Denny Craig. All right, everybody. Rock and roll.
It's about civil disobedience, Denny. It's about anarchy. It's about the girl.
From Forest Rain Studios, the home of Boston-Legal.org, you're connected to Boston Illegal Radio. And it's a story of rehab, bad dreams, honoring your grandfather, evading those taxes on principle, and Allen versus the government again. I'm Dana Greenlee, and you're listening to Boston Illegal. It's the unofficial weekly audio experience of Boston Legal, and that's the fabulous, invigorating David E. Kelley produced television show broadcast here in the United States on ABC along with 20th Century Fox, and a hand, of course, from the talented, compulsively perfectionist crew over at David E. Kelley Productions, and of course, the lovely cast members that we have. Today, Boston Legal Radio is essentially going to be a conversation about the 19th episode of season two, something they call Stick It. Well, I never do these podcasts alone. It's so much more interesting when you have conversations that go back and forth rather than a lecture series. So, of course, this week is no exception. I have a wonderful, lovely co-host. We're not going to tell you who she is right away. We're going to actually make her give us a little tease, some hints, and let's see if you can come up with her name before we get to the end of it. And if not, well, will you give us a reveal of who you are at the end? And don't say your name.
Yes, I will.
Okay, great. You have been ranked in a wonderful list at Stuffed Magazine, right? Stuffed Magazine?
Yep.
What was the name of that list?
Oh, boy. I think like the 100 most airbrushed women in the world.
Well, actually, the 102, you got sexiest women in the world. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
That magazine's all about that.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I don't think you'd recognize any of us on the street looking quite that.
Yeah,
big hair and all oiled up.
So did they oil you for that photograph?
Yeah, they tan you and shellac you with oil. And
Now, you grew up in a wonderful little town, Minneapolis.
Uh-huh.
But you spent a year in college somewhere else. Very cool, very exotic. Where was that?
Yes, Paris.
Wow. And you had to come back to the United States?
I know. How painful for me. It was actually a semester there, but it was a great, great experience. And then we traveled all over for the summer, over Europe.
Your rail pass, or did you go in style?
Oh, no, the year rail pass.
Your rail pass is great. I did a year in England, and then your rail
pass.
Oh,
yeah, you can't be 21 years old and do it in style. You gotta slum it on the
sleeper
cab and stuff.
Exactly. You gotta, you know, run to the best place, slide the doors closed, pull the drapes, and then you can sleep in there. And then
yes,
you wake up.
A bunch of people who have not showered in weeks.
Yes. You wake up in time to go to the tour at the Tuborg Brewery in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
All right. Back to the quiz. Now, this is the big one. Can you name all six episodes so far that you've been in?
Ooh. I might have to cheat. I'm in my office, so I think I have a few scripts here. But yes. Truly, Madly, Deeply. Ask That Jungle. Let's see. Legal Deficit. There was one that I was in a tiny little scene that was cut out, and I forget which one that was. But then The Cancer Man Can, Helping Hands, and most recently, Stick It.
You got that 100% perfect. And I would love to know the one that you cut out. If that comes to mind, pop
it out. I'll look. I'm sure I have it somewhere around here. But yeah, there was one that they threw me in this one little scene, and then they ended up cutting the whole scene. So.
Well, if we haven't already figured it out, everybody that's listening to you right now, why don't you reveal your name?
My name is Marisa Coughlin.
And you played?
Melissa Hughes.
Excellent. Excellent. That's wonderful. Your voice is unmistakable. And so. This episode, Stick It, that we're going to talk about today, has been probably the most controversial, probably the most talked about, and certainly by the statistics I can see on my website, which is boston-legal.org.
Uh-huh.
Four times, maybe five times as much traffic as in any previous episode.
Really?
And it's been sustained afterwards. So see what you did? Ratings jump.
Wow. Well, I hope they understand it's all about me.
It's all about
it's
you.
It's not about the script. It's that they used me.
There would be. Well, I understand what you're saying. We've got to give our dues to the writers. Who's that guy? I don't know. What's his name? David E. Kelley.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's more about me, I think, than Mr. Kelley.
Oh, yeah. You know, there wouldn't be. If you had you know, continued to pay your taxes as Melissa years ago, there would not even be an episode.
I know.
Well, I actually wanted to use this as part of our tease, but can you just give us a little flavor of Melissa right now? Just a line, any line that you want to from that episode.
Oh, I'll do the line that made me laugh. Well, amongst the many that made me laugh out loud when I first read it, but I laughed when I saw that I got to say, "You want to bone me up?"
That is wonderful. We will play that one pretty soon in the soundbite.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That's definitely great. And you referenced your grandfather. How sweet. I had to do that in a little teaser because I think that's the reason. It's family unity as well as embarrassment over your government.
Yeah.
And please forgive me if I say your, and I'm referring to Melissa, who's a fictional character.
Yes, no, I understand.
You do. All right. Well, I just want to spend a few minutes before we jump into the dissection of the episode talking about you, Marisa, about all the jobs that you've had. You've been an actor a long time, film, television, magazine covers. I'm the most excited. And let me just say, as soon as I saw that come through, I put it right up on the front page of boston-legal.org so everybody knew what you would be doing in the future.
Oh, you did? I didn't know that. That's
up there, including you. We put your birthday up there.
Oh,
happy birthday. That was a couple weeks ago, right?
It was. Thank you.
It was actually the week of the day that Stick It aired.
I know. Yeah. It was a good week for me. It was a lot of activity.
Yes. But anyway, you have been selected, cast as the star of a pilot that we hope to see in the fall.
Oh, God. Well, I hope you get to see it, too. Let me tell you. We're going to go into production in a couple weeks now. We've just been finalizing kind of the rest of the cast. But it's a really cute sitcom, which I've never actually done before. But I've done more comedy than anything else. So I think it'll be right up my alley, just sort of a different format. And it's written and executive produced by a woman named Shauna Goldberg-Meehan, who wrote for Friends for years and years. And is a very funny, talented writer. And it's actually autobiographical about her life experience with her sister, who's 10 years younger and was raised kind of in a different context, come into a lot of money in the meantime. So they had very different upbringings.
Your sister, who's Gabby, correct?
Yes. Kaylee Cuoco.
Okay. Oh, great.
From Eight Simple Rules. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
So you say you haven't started filming the pilot yet?
No, we haven't. We've been casting all the other players, and we start rehearsals in about 2 weeks, and then we shoot the 26th.
Actually, those of us who haven't been privy to the whole industry and how it works, do you know if you get picked up what network it would be for? Or is that
it's for ABC?
Oh, it is.
Yep. So it's all in the family because I've done most things for ABC television wise, and Kaylee did Eight Simple Rules for ABC for a long time, so. There's a lot of us that have worked for them. It's definitely, I feel much more comfortable there than any place, so I'm thrilled, yeah.
Is Eight Simple Rules no longer?
It is no longer, unfortunately. I know, it was a funny show. Fortunately for me, however, because I get to steal the funny Kaylee Cuoco from them.
That's great. I'm just curious, when you said it's with ABC and you've done a lot of work with ABC, when you sign a contract, are you signing with ABC or a series or kind of both? How does that work?
What do you mean specifically for this pilot?
Well, actually, I'm thinking for you. So I think I read somewhere that Justin Mintel signed a contract for 7 years with ABC. And I don't know if I understood that correctly.
Well, that would be specifically for Boston Legal. So if it continued for 7 years and Justin would sort of be locked into ABC and to Boston Legal.
Okay. So it's not like you're the company girl at ABC and you just get shipped
out. Whereas if the show ends, he's released from that contract or, you know, whatever happens. If they release him, it doesn't really apply to other shows. Uh-huh.
Sure.
Within the network, unless you do an overall deal, in which case they can sort of put you in any show.
Any show. I think I saw Julie Bowen, who plays Denise Bauer, interviewed on a talk show, and she said, I have to put in so many hours a week at ABC somehow, so, you know, I was a little light on the episode this week, so they shipped me over to Jimmy Kimmel to do a talk show.
You know?
I have to fill in my hours.
Yeah, we don't have a quota like that, but it would be okay with me if we did.
Yeah, that's true. You were actually on, was it Jimmy Kimmel in January, or you were on a talk show?
I did Carson Daly.
Carson Daly. Okay, that's good. Yeah, was that a fun experience?
It was great. It was really fun, yeah.
It was
my second episode in, and they announced me as the star of Boston Legal, so I felt kind of embarrassed. I'm like, well, wait, don't say that. But because I had just started, and I was like, I hope they don't think I'm the one filling them with that line. there's a few stars of Boston Legal, and I ain't one of them. I'm maybe guest star.
You are, and I think, you know, I hate to say this, but you've had more screen time than Justin or Ryan Michelle Bath.
You know, it's so funny with a show like this, because I think it's sort of like some characters really click with other characters, and I mean, when I started, it was literally a 3-episode arc, you know, I had absolutely no reason to believe it would be anything more than that. And yeah, it turned into like 11 or 12 episodes and so many great, fun things to do. So it's just funny how that plays out. I think once they create the character, they see like, oh, this is a good opportunity for this character to get into this trouble. And
and we needed a little bit of somebody to play off of Alan in that way, you know, in that sort of like sexy way.
Yeah.
That's unrequited. Or, I don't know. You know, there's this sort of wall that you put up between the two of you.
I know. I kind of love it.
It is good. And so that leads me to... Please tell us, we've known about six, maybe seven episodes. Are we going to see more? Because remember, we're just watching the last of the last week. We just saw the Word Salad Day when they went off. And we have, what, five, six, seven more episodes left in the season.
Yes. So I'm not in a few, the next few, I guess. And then I'm in, gosh, I forget all the names. Deep End of the Pool.
There you go.
And Race Ipsa.
You'll be in Race Ipsa.
Yes, little bits and pieces. Like it's certainly not like Stick It where I'm in, you know, so much of it. Just like kind of pop in and pop out. And the next one after that I'm in, and then I hear rumors, I should say, of the last two that I may be in. But who knows?
The last two will be the season finale, 2-hour finale, right?
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. So yeah, I hope so. Like I said to others in other interviews, it's like probably the most fun I've ever had on a show. So.
Oh.
Every time they call and ask me to do anything, I'm like, sure.
That's great.
I'll be in the background. I don't care. I just love it.
That's more like a real law firm when you have Melissa walking by and
I know.
Making a wise crack and not answering her phone and stuff.
I know.
Yeah, that's good. Also, just really quickly, I'd love to hear a little bit about your, I don't know, that experience when you first got the call from Boston Legal, you know, you were going to be cast. Actually, did they know about your work and call your agent or did you
They knew of me because I'd read for David Kelly a few years ago when he did that show Girls Club, and
oh yeah,
and this part was hard, I think, because all they had written was, you know, in the first episode I did that one monologue, and that's kind of all they had in place. So
and what was that? It was from Truly Madly Deeply? Was that when you said
that's when I came in and kind of read him the riot act?
I'm going to write you up if
you
do this.
Me, you will not. Which obviously was so great, but it's hard to know what you're signing up for, because they didn't know yet. And so, but I just trusted them and they said, but we want you to come in and read it because we want to see it in action. And so I just, you know, I was like, David Kelly and, Boston Legal is my favorite show on television. I'm like, you know what? Like I said, I'll do two lines on this show. So I went in and read for them and that was that. Yeah. And then got the next episode, which was the Night Terrors. And then I was like, so relieved that I had taken the leap of faith and you know, I've had so many unbelievably fun things to do in the interim. So
it's been amazing. I mean, the whole episode with the Night Terrors and you sleeping, well, it got everybody talking.
Yeah. Well, it's a great role because you're right. I've sort of laid down the law in the beginning. So there's like this weird sexual tension. Of course, it's all coming from me because I've become fallen head over heels for him, even though in the beginning I didn't have the time of day for him. But it's nice because it just sort of builds, but without it going too far. And we kind of walk this line where it's very friendly and it's very supportive and it's not just strictly sexual or anything. I know he's had a lot of sexual dalliances with other guest stars or other regulars, and I kind of like the way our relationship sort of walks that line.
Oh yeah, it's very good. I mean, it's actually the whole, and this is not what Melissa's all about. She's not a hard to get girl. She's not playing that.
God, just, no, apparently not.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I don't mean that in that she's easy. I just mean that she's not doing this on purpose to be
appealing.
She's
not coy. She doesn't play games.
Right.
she kind of calls it as she sees it.
Now, how much did they tell you when you went into the audition about her demeanor, the character's demeanor? And how would you describe that? Because I do not like the term bimbo or dumb blonde or anything like that.
And she's really not.
No.
I mean, they didn't give me much to go on. And then in that, I think in a sense, they didn't know yet which direction it was going to go completely. And in that initial monologue, you know, she could have been a real tough cookie based on the lines. But mm-hmm. in that sense, I didn't really know exactly, but I think on set, we decided to make her a little bit more playful. Mm-hmm. And then as the episodes of started to come out. I mean, they've definitely infused her with more of a, you know, the chewing gum, sexy sweatpants thing. And for me, that's the most fun to play anyway, because she's really an interesting character. She's bright. I mean, yeah. She's by no means a stupid girl. And she comes up with some pretty funny stuff, but she's also, you know, she's like a really smart teenager.
Yeah, she is.
Is the way I like to think of her.
That's true. She is. That's good. I wish her a ton of luck in the future episodes. I hope that she finds a really nice guy, if it's not Alan Shore.
I know. Well, I don't think she's going to let go of Alan for a while.
That's good. Well, we're going to get into more in depth about all the other projects, including the aptly named at this point, Untitled Sister Project.
Yes. Sisters. God, Project. We're all racking our brains for a title. So.
Well, seriously, did they ask your input?
If anyone thinks of something brilliant out there.
That's great. That's great. I think Sisters has been done, hasn't it? Back in the
80s. I think so.
Anyway, we'll get into more of that after we dissect the episode. But let's give, shall we, Marissa, everybody a sort of a rundown of what we're going to cover in the next hour. We'll be, of course, deconstructing Stick It. And you'll be providing great insights in what it was like in the context of the scene. I would like that. And finally, we'll get to some Boston Legal news of the week.
Okay, great.
Let's get right to how we're going to do Stick It. We're just going to take this, as we always do, storyline by storyline. There's the usual three storylines. Two of them this time are serious. One is lighthearted. We're going to start with the most important one. That's yours, Marissa's, Melissa's post-it note of protest. It's evading paying the federal income tax. Then we'll talk a little bit about Paul's continuing storyline, his tough love with his daughter, Rachel, and the lighthearted one, Denise, who's found sort of a very dubious love with a policeman.
The least.
Yeah. And we always end with the balcony scene. I just love that balcony scene.
Ugh.
I would like to get your feedback
on
that.
Always
one.
So magical.
They are indeed. Now, this is interesting. Stick It was directed by Adam Arkin.
Uh-huh.
And this was the first time we've had an actor / director and for the whole two seasons. So it was great because he's been in several episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he plays ADA Doug Kopfer. He wasn't in this episode.
No.
And I want to find out what you think of what it was like working with Arkin. Did he give you some good direction or did he leave it up to you?
No. You know, what's funny is actors are so all over the place. And I think especially actors who've been on the show forever who have their characters down pat. I don't really love getting, maybe, you know, I shouldn't generalize, but sometimes I don't love getting a lot of direction. I, on the other hand, love it, especially when it's an actor who,
he's been on the other side, yeah.
Yeah, he's been on the other side, and he's very, Adam specifically is really good at articulating, what he means, and so he helped me a lot in terms of when I said earlier, she's kind of like a smart teenager. you know, he was relaying stories to me about his daughter and, some, like when she'd gotten in trouble for certain things and, kind of like the eye rolls and the
and flipping the hair, maybe, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And so he sort of helped me, you know, led me towards that because I was, you know, I didn't want to take it too far with that. And he was like, you can go further. So he kind of helped me steer it in that direction, which I think played better and was fun to do. And okay. Yeah, that hair flip, it's so funny because he had me do that, the walk away. He's like, okay, just do this walk away and just kind of work it. So I, you know, I'm not the type to really work it that much with one of those kind of things, but I did it. And then he's like, yeah, okay. We got that. Do it again. You can go even further, which is when I did the hair flip kind of as a joke.
Uh-huh.
And I came back and of course he's like, we're definitely going to use the hair flip.
It was your idea, the hair flip.
Yes.
Well, I guess it must kind of mute out a little bit when it gets in air. I mean, you can feel like it's way too much when you're doing it, but it was great. And then, of course, they do it super slow-mo on it.
Yeah, I know. I know. Well, it was just one of those things where I just trusted that when they saw it in the context of the rest of the episode, they would know if it was too far or whatever. And like I said, I did it more as a joke because he was like, go even further. And then, of course, it ends up in the episode. But I thought it was funny.
Oh, yeah. And in the message boards, I think someone posted, Melissa Hughes knew she was being watched. You know, she walked away. It was kind of like, yes.
It's true. It's true. If she's ever going to work it, that was her moment to try to lure Alan in.
And, oh, I was going to say the episode, as we alluded to earlier, was written by David E. Kelley. And Janet Leahy, is that how I say her name?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And these two have written several together. But, it's interesting. David has written about 22, 23 of the 33-some episodes that have been written about Boston Legal.
Yeah.
So not every one, but yet it was really great that he's written this one. And I just kind of want to know, again, from someone who's fascinated about what it's like to shoot things and, you know, on set, but we'll never know, do they hover? Do they watch you say their lines? Do they?
Oh, God, not at all. It's so funny. It's just David Kelley's team has been with them forever. I mean, you know, Picket Fences, Ellie McBeal, and the practice, and the directors rotate, and a lot of them are the executive producers. Even the, you know, DP directs occasionally, and it's really kind of all in the family.
It is. It's kind of nice when they have multiple, they can have multiple credits, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, for me, it's like, it's, I've only been there this season, and I feel so comfortable there, and I know everyone, I've gotten to know everyone really well, and it's nice to have that familiarity of the directors that rotate, that are the people that you see from week to week anyway, because they're the executive producers, and so I think because of that, everyone can breathe a sigh of relief that you're in good hands, and even the directors that aren't executive producers are really familiar with the whole Boston Legal team, and everyone feels confident that they're, that they know what they're doing and that they can handle the tone of it so well that the writers don't have her, David Kelly doesn't have her, like nobody does.
Oh, that's good. That's really
good. There's just like a quiet confidence about the whole thing.
In your 6 or 7 episodes that you've done so far, did you have the same director on any one of them? Like
I've
Jim McGonis or you know, Mike Listo or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I will work with them in this next episode, one of them. I think I've worked with each of them once.
Okay.
And then...
you've got all the different styles, but...
Well, yeah, exactly.
It's your style, actually.
Lou Antonio I worked with twice, who I'd actually worked with a couple of years ago on a different series, and I think he's been around.
Oh, which series was that?
It was called Wasteland. It was, to be honest, 5 years ago?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wasteland is a cult favorite, right? Yeah.
So he directed an episode of that. So he directed Helping Hands, mm-hmm. and then Res Ipsa, he directed as well.
Oh, great. Great. Lou Antonio. And I think I remember looking up information on him, and you're right. He's like a veteran.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was in Cool Hand Luke as an actor.
Oh, my goodness. That is amazing.
Yeah. And he's just the greatest guy. So
another actor director.
Yeah.
Okay, this is so much fun. This is what I love about you, Marisa. You love to go off on tangents, and I encourage that greatly. So don't ever think, oh, I can't say this. Don't edit yourself, please. We're going to start the deconstruction with, of course, the start of the show, which is you. And the I love the music as they edited in later.
I know. You know,
the sound of was these two agents, FBI. Or
we're
at least,
very intimidating looking.
Yes, and it kind of goes, you know.
Yeah.
It's great. It's almost a sort of a Men in Black moment.
It definitely was.
And you play it really well. Let's listen to that scene.
Melissa Hughes?
Why?
Are you Melissa Hughes?
Alan? These people are looking for a Melissa Hughes. They have guns.
What's going on? Can we see some identification, please?
Do I have to do that? Don't I have the right to not incriminate myself?
Could we start with you identifying yourselves?
I'm Special Agent Joseph Reynolds with the U.S. Treasury Department. This is Special Agent Thomas Lay, also with the Treasury Department. Are you Melissa Hughes?
All right.
Please put your hands behind your back, Miss Hughes.
What?
I asked before, I'll do so again. What is going on?
This woman is under arrest for evasion of federal income taxes. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to speak to an attorney.
I'm her attorney. We'll waive Miranda. There's no need to take her into custody. I'll surrender her myself at her arraignment.
I'm sorry, sir. Let's go, ma'am.
Hold on. Did you just call me ma'am?
No talking, Melissa, and don't be making any statements. I'll be there as soon as I can.
And you get pulled onto the elevator. It was great. I love that little, you know, you want to stamp your foot over this injustice.
Definitely.
And what do you remember about filming that scene? And I'm sure it didn't come first on the list of things to film, but what did you think about when you were getting hauled off? Ma'am.
You know, yeah, it was kind of technical, that scene, because there were a lot of different people to coordinate and just the right timing of us circling that corner. And there was actually a little piece in there that they cut out where I kind of like speak to the other people in the office. This is no big deal. I used to date these guys or something. And they ended up cutting that part probably for the same reason that it was logistically just difficult to coordinate everything. And
you were looking for some excuse to that. Like,
I was a little embarrassed, I guess, trying to justify being dragged out of the office by two giant men police officers. But no, it was fine. And it kind of set the tone, I guess, for the, like you said, when I make that little noise, like for the just girl who's in trouble, who's just annoyed.
I didn't do it. Deny. Now, is Melissa meant to be working now back? Has the Chinese wall come down and she's now working?
Yes, it's down. I'm his assistant again, definitely.
Oh, fantastic. Now, I did look up a little information about your two co-stars. They're the guest stars, the two federal marshals that came in. And one of them was actually who played Thomas Lahey's Brad James. He played Arnold Schwarzenegger in a documentary.
These
really? Guys. Yeah, it wasn't the African-American then, I guess.
I wouldn't imagine.
Yeah.
Really, I didn't know that. Well, I know one of them had done, I think, some work for David Kelly's one of his shows in the past.
Yeah, in fact, on The Practice, Robert Joseph, he was the African-American guy.
Uh-huh.
He played Joseph Reynolds.
Yeah.
He was in The Practice, immortalized in this scene when Alan hid a knife, which was a murder weapon that a client had handed him just before the police break into The Practice and you know, say, are you harboring a fugitive in here?
Uh-huh.
I guess we'll see in the future episode of Boston Legal. And and he goes, bad policeman, bad, to him. It was really a good scene because you may have just cost us our business if you chased away our potential client. That was a great scene. But yes, thank you for providing a little context to that.
And it's, oh, sure, yeah.
It's always interesting to hear about cut scenes, cut dialogue, because to me, to many of us, every word is precious.
Me too. It's funny when they do cut things because I always feel a little pain when I see it. Something's gone because every single thing is so funny that they make it work so well and then you don't miss it. But, you know, only because I knew it was there, I miss it.
Well, you know, yes. And especially if they take out all of your appearance in that episode.
Right.
I did read an article about with the two of the editors and they said that they film. It's multiple angles of multiple cameras as well, but about 30 to 40 hours for a 41-minute final product. So, you know, it's got to be cut.
Yeah, I guess you got to make a few nips and tucks there, huh?
A few. Well, let's move on to the next scene because this is Melissa when she is, this is you, when you are now sitting in a cell. By the way, is that cell on set somewhere? And do they have just a handy cell set because so many people end up...
You know, it's funny, like the little bit I've worked on the show, I've already been in two or three jail cells. And I noticed that it's funny, they don't cheat. They make a new jail cell every time.
Oh, they do.
Oh, they've got so many jail cells they crank out. So.
This has got to be my favorite episode, you know, this scene in a way, because call 1-800-Lizzie.
Oh, I know.
From that first one, the first
when
trouble.
When I say back off, ho.
Yeah, back off. It was awesome.
Yeah, I laughed when I saw that line. I was like, oh, that'll be good. That'll be fun to deliver.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's play this little scene. This is where you're sort of like, huh, can't you just make it go away, Alan?
Okay.
I'm not sure I can get you out of this.
Can't you just make one of those really, really long speeches like you did with my credit card thingy?
This is a little bit more serious than not paying your credit card bills.
Oh, come on. I can't be the first person to forget to pay her taxes.
You sent the form back with a note saying, stick it.
I was extremely close to my grandfather.
I'm sure you feel you've just explained things.
He served in World War II. I mean, he was such a proud American, and I just started thinking how embarrassed he would be by what's happening today.
What's happening?
Us torturing people, spying on our own people, squashing everybody's civil liberties. My grandfather would weep. It makes me weep.
Melissa, you need to change the channel. The awful things you speak of never happen on the Fair and Balanced newscast.
Once again, David making that little dig on
I know.
Conservative news channels, cable channels. This is an example of what you said. Like, she's very intelligent. She knows what's going on
yeah.
in the world. This was not an excuse then for just, you know, trying to save money on
paying taxes.
Oh, no. This is a real principled stand.
It definitely is. She just goes about it in a slightly immature way. But, you know, she's making a stand, and it's a well-thought-through position that she takes. It's just, you know, she doesn't do what the rest of us would do, like write a letter to a congressman or something. But she even acknowledges that and says, I don't think they'll read it. I don't think they'll pay attention to it. Only by breaking the law and by, you know, kind of making a fuss over in the corner will someone actually pay attention to what I have to say. So it is smart.
That's right. If all Melissa wanted to do was just save money so she could buy from Crate and Barrel or whatever code name they gave the Crate and Barrel, you know.
Right.
Then she wouldn't bother mailing it back with a stick it post-it note on it.
No.
This was her way of just saying, hey.
She wants to make some noise. She wants to be heard. And this is, in her mind, the best way to do it.
That's good. We actually move right into the courtroom scene, which, oh, please give me, well, I don't know if I want to do this before or after. Let's play the soundbite first. Then I want you to just prognosticate about what you thought about working with Shelley Berman, who is the judge.
And yes.
Wow. 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 It's so cool. So here we go with Melissa being in her charges being spelled out for her.
41625, the United States versus Melissa Hughes, violation of Internal Revenue Code 76.
Alan Shore for Ms. Hughes, Your Honor. I believe we can waive reading. And in fact, since the total amount is around $400, I would submit that my client simply pay it together with late penalties and we can dispose of this.
The government's not interested in a deal, Your Honor. The defendant didn't just fail to pay her taxes. She wrote stick it on a post-it and attached it to her returns.
Your Honor, it's quite simple. When my client filed her taxes, she inadvertently mailed the post-it note she had written to herself as a reminder to stick the check in the mail.
What is this jibber-jabber? I don't like jibber-jabber in my courtroom.
Oh, my goodness.
Your client stands accused of a federal crime. Do you want a trial, Mr. Shaw?
Immediately.
Mr. Shapiro?
The government stands ready.
10 a.m. tomorrow. And I would ask counsel to check his sense of humor at the door. My courtroom is a temple of decorum, and I do not tolerate jibber-jabber.
I hear you laughing, Risa.
Oh, I love him.
He's been, Shelley Berman has been around for acting for 50 years.
And yeah.
Of course, I'm most familiar with him, Larry David's father on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I know, me too. I immediately was just kind of all over him. I was so obsessed because I love that show.
Oh, you do. You watch that. You're aware of that. Yes. He's great. And he looks different. I mean, he's got those big old glasses, those thick glasses, you know.
Yeah.
Curb Your Enthusiasm. But, you know, did you know he won the first ever Grammy ever for a non-musical recording back in 1959
for a
stand-up comedian thing.
Really?
Isn't that amazing? First ever given to a stand-up comedian for recording a Grammy.
Really? Well, he is so cute. He had his birthday the day we shot that scene.
No way. So he's very close to your birthday. Oh, no, that's right. This was shot
you know,
a long time before.
I know.
Sorry.
Yeah, not that long before, but yeah. But they, well, first of all, he's so funny. He has all the, like, the only jokes I can even remember in my whole life are the jokes that he told that day because they were so funny.
Oh, you mean off camera, like jokes? Just,
oh my gosh. He sat because he's obviously the judge sitting up there, and there was, you know, a lot of background players and everything, and everyone's sitting in the back of the courtroom, and he would literally sit up there all day and do stand up. Just
sit
roll
down.
I mean, joke after joke after joke, and the whole room is like doubled over laughing the whole day.
Oh, that's wonderful.
He's so adorable and the sweetest man. And then they gave him they brought, as is their tradition, whoever's birthday it is, whether it's cast or crew or whatever, they bring out a cake, and they brought out a cake and candles, and he gave this little speech after he blew out the candles, and it was basically like the equivalent of, the wish I would make today is that I could continue to work with people as wonderful as you on a show like this and have the privilege of coming back to a show. I'm not exaggerating, and I'm not a weepy person, but I had tears in my eyes. It was the sweetest thing I've ever heard.
Oh.
I know. He's a really sweet man and also a very edgy, funny man. I guess he was in The Aristocrats.
Oh, yes.
and his jokes I can't repeat because they were... No.
Oh, really? So he's like got a wicked mouth.
Yeah, he has his moments, but some were pretty clean. He kept them pretty clean for
this is really
interesting. Audience.
He's not just a corny guy, you know, like a lot of old people who've done it forever.
Oh, no.
They recycle.
No.
He is edgy, you said.
He's got plenty of edge left in him, that's for sure.
You know, he's been on, most of us just grew, like you mentioned, The Aristocrats, and, you know, most of us grow up only hearing about these ancient shows that are, but he was on Ed Sullivan a bunch of times.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
This is just amazing. That's like iconic.
Oh, I know. I think he's so funny in this role as well. I mean, he did such a great job with the material, and then on top of it, he's hilarious off camera.
I just love it. So how long did it take you to film the multiple courtroom scenes? I know.
Yeah, it took us a while.
Multiple days, probably.
Yeah, a couple of days. Just because, you know, there's a lot of long speeches, and you got to not only get, obviously, the actor delivering the speech, but cover everybody reacting to it, which...
Yeah,
takes a while.
You mentioned it was his birthday, and I just landed on this. He turned 80 at that birthday.
Was it 80?
Isn't that amazing?
I don't remember if we knew that or not.
Oh,
but,
no. He may not have made a big deal out of it.
Yeah, he was like, I'm turning 65. No, he was just the sweetest guy.
This is amazing. He taught at USC for 22 years.
He did?
Prof. Berman.
He was a what professor?
You know, I don't know. What did he teach? Let's see.
Because I went to USC. I wonder if I was there when
did.
He was there.
He actually taught at USC the Master's in Professional Writing program for 22 years.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. It's just, and so you have to go to usc.edu. It's a long link, so I won't say it right now, but actually there's a whole page on it with pictures of him and the stuff. It's under College News, so you actually go to the College News section.
Well, it doesn't surprise me because he's a very witty, funny guy. I'm sure he has lots to offer to fellow writers.
Also, in that scene, we haven't heard him speak yet, but... I thought it was really interesting. There was Scott Paulin played the U.S. attorney, the opposite of Alan Shore in your case. And they gave him the name, U.S. Attorney, Jonathan Shapiro. Is that a familiar name to you? Jonathan is a writer for, and I guess as they tend to hand out the executive producer credits, you know, at Boston Legal. So it's another example of where, and they've done this before, where they've, let's think of a character name for this attorney. Oh, well, let's use your name, buddy.
I know. There's always people with the last name Leahy. And
oh, yeah.
Like, I think, wasn't one of the guards that came to get me, when it wasn't one of his last name Leahy? Like,
oh, you know, it.
Yeah.
I'll take your word for it, and I have to go check
Federal Marshal Thomas Leahy.
Oh, that's Janet's last name. That's great.
Yeah, they do that a lot. It's funny.
That's right. In this episode, in Denise's storyline. So you watched this on television, right? So you got to see
yeah.
the whole thing.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good. And then she had been matched up with Shirley Schmidt's nephew, and his name was Michael Reese Rice. I don't know how you say it, but he's also a writer and on Boston Legal. So the little guy that does, clicks his tongue, you know, at Denise and uh-huh. all schmarmy. I feel sorry for Michael, the real Michael, because I'd much rather be the noble
right.
Jonathan Shapiro.
Right, exactly.
All right. Well, with that, we could go on and on about the wonderful guest stars, but I want to, you know, get through all these wonderful sound bites. And we have now, we have the scene where Alan Shore takes Melissa over and says, you know, I don't know about winning this. This is going to be kind of hard. And you basically convince him why it should be important.
We've stipulated as to your non-compliance, the only testimony to be taken would be yours.
Okay.
I'll take one last shot at settling it.
Actually, I've decided I want to continue with the trial.
Sorry?
I think it's what my grandfather would want.
Oh, you've got to be kidding me. Please, stop talking about your grandfather.
But...
Lisa, the prosecution is looking to make a point. You could go to jail for a long time. Are you listening to me?
Yeah. You get to go and fight battles for things you believe in every day, and it is so admirable. I've never really stood up for anything. I know it sounds all stars and stripey, but my grandfather, I'm sorry, but he did. He talked about the America he fought for. Now I want to fight for it.
Okay, first of all, and I think your grandpa would agree with me, there's nothing more American than paying your taxes.
I want to have my day in court.
At the risk of having your day in prison.
You want to bone me up?
I beg your pardon?
From a testimony. Shouldn't you prep me?
You seem prepped.
You okay?
Head hurts.
Brilliant. There's that wonderful line. And you know, that's the only time you make his head hurt. He says it later on.
I know. It doesn't make sense to him that he could be attracted to someone as flighty as me, I think.
No. Do you think? I don't know about that. I think I would know. I'm not really entirely serious about this, but I think he's been so enamored of Denny Crane lately that it's just like, the concept of a woman now.
I know.
Actually, we would love, I think the fact that you are that, I don't know if I want to call it protagonist, but you're the person that's like pushing the sexuality factor to him from a heterosexuality, you know, standpoint.
Yeah.
It's kind of refreshing for everybody. We all want to say like, go for it, Alan, because, I don't know. I think they've probably done as much as they probably should do with the whole, you know, I don't know what's going on between Denny and Alan. So it's all cute and everything.
Yeah.
Maybe it's gone an episode too far. Of course, I put that on just the fact that they write these things like 6 weeks before it actually
right,
ends
right.
the airing. So they're kind of we're playing catch up. But people love it. But I kind of want to see Alan. I definitely would like to have see him bone you up. You know what
well,
I mean?
Well, yeah. You know, he has such a strong sexual energy. And I know in the beginning of the series, they had him really pursuing women like crazy. Mm-hmm. And they've kind of toned that down a bit. And I think it is refreshing that they made this character, which as much as she's not his equal on some levels, she kind of holds... kind of like yeah. maintain some power with him, and even when he says no, she says yes, and
oh yes,
you know, it's kind of refreshing to see that, because you're used to seeing women say no and he says yes, and that's the way it goes down, and
it definitely it makes you wonder about what really is going on inside of the inner Alan, because you're right, he's made a shift,
and, yeah,
And I'm so glad that she keeps, I don't know if you saw episode or season one, there was a Nora, you know, basically you're the anti-Nora in that she was a little timid about him. She was an assistant and a little timid about him and coming on to her.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you're very forthright and I love
yeah.
that. Or Melissa is, excuse me. And, I like that you pushed it at the end and we'll play that soundbite soon. I think everybody wants to know what that scene was like to film. We'll get to that in a few minutes.
Okay.
The next soundbite I do want to play, this is your testimony on the stand where you actually give your rationale. And it indeed comes across, of course, as the real reason, not just like I alluded to before, that maybe
right.
it was just you wanted to save some money for Crate and Barrel.
Right.
So, again, I think the fact that, and Alan points it out, you know, he says, don't confuse dissent with disloyalty in this soundbite. That was used in Witches of Mass Destruction. That was just before I think you came on board. I don't know if you were in there. And that was the soldiers
you know,
being kept on longer. And they used that. And it was an Edward R. Murrow quote. I just have to throw this in there. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. When the loyal opposition dies, I think the soul of America dies with it. So that's Edward R. Murrow. Of course, made more popular after Good Night and Good Luck.
Yeah.
Let's listen to your delivery of Melissa Hughes's testimony on the stand.
I've always believed the United States was not only the strongest country, but also the most moral one.
And so naturally, that's what prompted you to tell them to stick it.
I just felt so embarrassed.
Embarrassed? Over?
Well, I guess first, the whole weapons of mass destruction thing. Now, maybe we lied, maybe we made a mistake, but either way, as goofs go, to start a war? Hello?
It embarrassed you.
Didn't it you?
Objection.
Miss Hughes, please do not address the jury.
Okay.
It seems as though you oppose the war.
Actually, I don't. If the government had said we need to do anything to get rid of Saddam, I would have said, let's roll. And if we had apologized after making such a humongous gaffe with the whole weapons thingy, I'm sure I could have accepted that too. But instead, we were so arrogant. It was embarrassing.
Yes. Anything else?
Torture. Our military tortured prisoners. Aren't we supposed to be the country that stands for human rights? I mean, doesn't it just make you want to hide?
Miss Hughes.
And spying. Okay, we spy on our own citizens now? All this to fight terrorists because they're a threat to freedom as we know it? I mean, talk about burning down the barn to kill the rats. Am I the only one embarrassed by this?
What about the military, Miss Hughes? Have our soldiers embarrassed you?
I've always been as proud of our troops as I am grateful.
Now, I believe you said that you're actually for the war. I guess you'd be for winning it.
Of course.
Well, what chance do you think we'd have of victory if people started not paying their taxes?
Not good.
But I guess if you're ashamed enough to be an American, it's okay.
She never said she was ashamed to be. She said she was embarrassed as. A distinction often missed by those who confuse dissent for disloyalty.
Mr. Shaw, sit down.
I am sitting. Okay, you got me. But I was about to sit after objecting to the DA's jibber-jabber.
There he goes again.
There I go again.
Stop with the jibber-jabber. The issue here is, did she pay her taxes? She didn't. You be quiet, Mr. Shaw. And Mr. Shapiro, sit down while you're ahead. We will have closing arguments, and then the jury will rule, and then I will give my sentence.
Small point, Judge. You probably shouldn't indicate to the jury you expect a sentencing. I could be wrong.
Enough jibber jabber.
Oh, man. Vermin. I know David and Janet. They're the ones that put the words in his mouth.
Exactly.
But I don't know. They put the word hello in your mouth. And I love that, though.
I know.
It's like, were you kidding me? It really, Melissa has just given Alan Shore his wonderful closing arguments because you listed everything first.
Yeah.
And then he just like goes, oh, yeah, you know, this is what I'm going to do.
He does it in a far more brilliant way, but yes.
Again.
Same gist.
Melissa is way, you know, she's like the more than just the support of Alan Shore. She's giving him his closing.
Yeah, some ammunition.
Ammunition. What do you think about filming that scene? Did you do it all in one take? They make you do multiples. I mean, Adam Arkin probably made you.
We definitely did multiples. And that's, I mean, when I was saying earlier, when he was sort of pushed me in the direction of going more in the sort of teenage eye roll direction,
mm-hmm.
he pushed me there. And that's, you know, and a lot of it ended up in the in the final episode where I'm, you know, when the judge tells me to, you know, not to address the jury, and I kind of like, oh, fine, and roll my eyes. And, you know, that stuff that was per his request, kind of in the take that was a little more, you know, teeny boppery, but it works for her because she's a real interesting dichotomy of.
That's true. Her words are adult, you know, very
exactly
measured and intelligent.
And her behavior is like 12.
Yeah, there you go. That's it. That must be hard to act because you're conveying in words one level of yourself and of the character, and the actions are really.
Yeah, it's funny. It's just tricky because, you know, especially particularly in this episode, this is the first episode where she really shows that she does have some range and that she's got some pretty, you know, the ability to process some pretty heavyweight issues as opposed to just being kind of flippant and like more comedically adolescent in some ways in some of the previous episodes. So it's like I said, it's a fine line to walk because you don't want to have her all of a sudden be a new person. I mean, mm-hmm. she's still that girl that is a little bit adolescent, but she's also showing a new side of herself, which is that she's pretty contemplative and does take some things pretty seriously. So you have to kind of find an interesting yeah. middle ground there, I guess.
And I know you said earlier that Alan's attraction to Melissa was kind of interesting because he'd always gone for maybe, you know, the more intelligent, I don't know, thought-provoking person. And here you are exhibiting all those rather than just...
Which is probably why his head hurts.
Oh, yeah. You're out of character for him.
Exactly. And all of a sudden I have a brain and he's like, oh, I'd written you off.
Which, why doesn't he just pursue it? I mean, if he could do it on the elevator with that other lady, you know?
I know. Maybe he has some respect for me because I threw down yes. in the beginning and laid down the law.
Oh, yes. So. He doesn't want to get written up. He doesn't want you photocopying.
Right? I don't know that he's so threatened by me anymore, but
yeah. This is fabulous. I just love you're doing such a great job with
behind-the-scenes
stuff. Now you're talking to him. And it's actually he is actually trying to warn you that you just still may not you may still not be making it through the trial unscathed.
Yeah,
let's see what he has to say.
Right,
Melissa, you could very well go to prison.
Yeah, you'll visit me, right? You gonna make one of those really long speeches? They're so hot.
I can stand up and argue just about any case, but the long shots, of which this is one, are different. Those I need to somehow believe in. And unfortunately, what I believe here is that you broke the law.
Well, then I guess between now and the time you jump up, you're going to have to find something to believe in.
Aww. The character was not intimidated by his little, you know, I don't believe in you.
No.
I would have found that a little heartbreaking. It's like, you don't believe in my position.
You know, I think I'm so right. That I'm just like, well, I'm sure between now and then you'll realize that I'm right.
Yeah, that's true. You're kind of predicting it, which confounds males all the time.
Right.
When women can say, well, you're going to come around eventually to my way of thinking.
Right.
Now we're going to hear a little bit from Denny and Alan talking about Melissa and the case and how he views your character and fruity chewing gum.
What's this all about? Talk to me. It's about civil disobedience, Denny. It's about anarchy. It's about the girl. I have a completely inexplicable, unwarranted, small, but embarrassing crush on the girl.
That girl?
She's fruity chewing gum, shopping malls, and sexy sweatpants. And whereas I'm not. I have no intention of acting on it, nor do I regard it as anything more than a moment's passing fancy, but as moments go. Ugh, my head hurts.
Here you go with the second, my head hurts.
I know.
So how do you feel about listening to him talk about your character like that?
Well, you know, I think he's kind of right. You know, it's true. I am all those things. I am other things too, which is why I think he knows he wouldn't normally be attracted to a girl who was all about chewing gum and shopping malls, but I think he knows there's something more there, so it's confounding him.
Yeah, I think that the part about the small infatuation, nah, it's a little bit bigger than that. I think so. He doesn't want Denny to get jealous, though.
I know, yes. Denny, I don't think, has much of a crush on me.
Oh,
Denny well, wants to get rid of me.
This doesn't make sense. Yeah, I guess because of the, you know, she's
his
coming
loopholes.
Between. Yeah, he worked his way into Ellen's bedroom, you know?
Right.
He didn't really like the fact that you were in there, which, oh man, I wish we could have had you for that, the dissection of that one, because that was lovely with his night terrors.
Yeah, it was a funny episode.
You were very sexy in your sweatpants.
Yeah.
As he just remembered.
In my snowsuit.
Oh yes, this Michelin man. Now we've come to really the standout. This is the shot heard around the world. This is the one. This is the closing argument of Alan. It goes on for like 4 minutes.
Oh yeah, I know.
And he's, or I should say, David E. Kelly or Janet, you know, they've done a wonderful job. And this is, this actually, these words won Boston Legal the Wings of Freedom Award,
wow,
which is a huge website that's out there, this huge sort of blog that, you know, is very political. And I mean, they've got millions of subscribers and they awarded that because, I guess they do it every so often. Never done it for a TV show or anything.
Uh-huh.
And this is exactly what our, you know, Democrats should be saying out there in Congress about what's going on. It's actually the reason why I think our website visitors just skyrocketed, you know, to set almost 18,000 people just in that one day.
Yeah.
You know, right after it did. And it's just been crazy. So we're going to play this for you now.
Okay.
Love to hear your thoughts afterwards about filming that scene.
Yeah.
When the weapons of mass destruction thing turned out not to be true, I expected the American people to rise up. They didn't. Then, when the Abu Ghraib torture thing surfaced and it was revealed that our government participated in rendition, a practice where we kidnap people and turn them over to regimes who specialize in torture, I was sure then the American people would be heard from. We stood mute. Then came the news that we jailed thousands of so-called terrorist suspects, locked them up without the right to a trial or even the right to confront their accusers. Certainly, we would never stand for that. We did. And now it's been discovered the executive branch has been conducting massive illegal domestic surveillance on its own citizens, you and me. And I at least consoled myself that finally, finally, the American people will have had enough. Evidently, we haven't. In fact, if the people of this country have spoken the messages, we're okay with it all. Torture, warrantless search and seizures, illegal wiretappings, prison without a fair trial, or any trial, war on false pretenses. We as a citizenry are apparently not offended. There are no demonstrations on college campuses. In fact, there's no clear indication that young people even seem to notice. Well, Melissa Hughes noticed. Now, you might think, instead of withholding her taxes, she could have protested the old-fashioned way, made a placard and demonstrated at a presidential or vice presidential appearance. But we've lost the right to that as well. The Secret Service can now declare free speech zones to contain, control, and in effect, criminalize protest. Stop for a second and try to fathom that. At a presidential rally, parade, or appearance, if you have on a supportive t-shirt, you can be there. If you're wearing or carrying something in protest, you can be removed. This in the United States of America. This in the United States of America. Is Melissa Hughes the only one embarrassed?
Mr. Shaw, that's a chair for witnesses only.
Really long speeches make me so tired sometimes.
Please get out of the chair.
Actually, I'm sick and tired.
Get out of the chair.
And what I'm most sick and tired of is how every time somebody disagrees with how the government is running things, he or she is labeled un-American.
Evidently, it's speech time.
And speech in this country is free, you hack. Free for me, free for you, free for Melissa Hughes to stand up to her government and say, stick it.
Objection.
I object to government abusing its power to squash the constitutional freedoms of its citizenry. And God forbid anybody challenge it. They're smeared as being a heretic. Melissa Hughes is an American. Melissa Hughes is an American. Melissa Hughes is an American.
Mr. Shaw, Unless you have anything new and fresh to say, please sit down. You've breached the decorum of my courtroom with all this hooting.
Last night, I went to bed with a book. Not as much fun as a 29-year-old, but the book contained a speech by Adlai Stevenson. The year was 1952. He said, "The tragedy of our day is the climate of fear in which we live, and fear breeds repression. Too often, sinister threats to the Bill of Rights, to freedom of the mind, are concealed under the patriotic cloak of anti-communism." Today, it's the cloak of anti-terrorism. Stevenson also remarked, "It's far easier to fight for principles than to live up to them." I know we are all afraid, but the Bill of Rights, we have to live up to that. We simply must. That's all Melissa Hughes was trying to say. She was speaking for you. I would ask you now to go back to that room and speak for her.
Very, very moving. And your character, Melissa, just did an amazing job of listening to him admiringly. What I like to call the Mona Lisa poses. Tell me all about your feeling on that, filming that.
I think that everything that he does for me is sort of infused with an element of I'm kind of in love with him. So it's obviously, you know, from the night before when he said, "I don't know if you're going to win and I don't really believe you should win," to this, it's such a turn and it's such a well thought through, obviously, speech. And what he says is everything I believe in. So, and then on top of it, I've got this enormous crush to begin with. So I think that as much as I'm under pressure and worried about the outcome of my life and going to prison and all that, it's kind of overwhelmed by the fact that he is so impressive to me. And, you know, I look up to him and admire what he's saying so much.
He did step up. He listened to your coach talk at the beginning, you know,
yeah.
And he said, "You got to find out a way to believe in it." And,
yeah.
You know, he took notes while
he did. And I know that he's not the type of person who's going to phone that in. I mean, he only says it when he means it. So it's like I know that he sort of thought through what I said, and that he suddenly sees where I'm coming from is not frivolous. It's a meaningful stance.
Were those easy scenes for you to film? Because you didn't have to say anything, but certainly the camera took a lot of close-ups of you.
You know, it was a really fun scene to do because he's just such a great actor to watch. I mean, he did the first take. I don't think he missed a word. Like straight through the entire monologue. And I mean, the whole room started clapping. It's like, he's just such a,
wow.
I don't know how he does it, to be honest. But, you know, David Kelly has certainly found an appropriate voice for his words because he does it so magnificently. And so to sit there, it's just like, it's like going to, you know, acting class or something.
We all, you know, it's so easy when you're watching that to sort of like really examine the mannerisms he uses. And they're very Alan Shore.
They are.
It does this sort
the
of
buttoning
like
and the unbuttoning of the coat and the
exactly
the hand on the stomach.
It was. You've picked up the same things we all talk about.
Yeah.
That coat buttoning thing, you know, it's been around.
It's so funny. I love it.
So I understand. Am I correct in thinking that a lot of the characters, and this can apply to yours and his, I mean, just your observation working in lots of television, that the writers sort of leave mannerisms up to you?
Definitely not scripted.
Okay. They don't give a lot of like side notes about this is what you should do at the time you're saying.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's cool.
Nothing. Nothing, and the directors really don't either, especially when it comes to Alan, because, I mean, James knows best.
And he's consistent throughout. He knows what
so
he's done every
consistent.
Season, whereas, you know, a director's new each time, maybe.
Yeah, and James is just, I mean, I don't know, because we haven't talked about it, how much he, like, pre-plans those things or how much it's just an organic part of what who he is once he's embodying that character. Because it seems to be, and, you know, like, I'm on set a lot and sit there and watch him. It seems to be pretty organically just part of what he does without, you know, pre-planned or, you know, without really thinking through it. I just think it's part of who Alan Short has become to him.
Yeah, sometimes we as viewers hear that, you know, actors will stay in a character or revert back to their normal selves and then just switch it on and off. What do you think is his sort of demeanor on that? Does he stay in between scenes in his Alan Shore-ness?
You know, James and Alan Shore aren't that far apart. You know, he's a very articulate, very smart man. James, I'm saying. And it's not a huge departure for him, but yeah, I would say he switches between. It's not like he stays in Alan Shore mm-hmm. mode between takes.
How about
there are certainly differences, but mm-hmm.
So he's not Shelley Berman that he's like, you know, Mr. Jibber Jabber and then,
right.
then he makes stand-up jokes.
Right. So there's a real huge discrepancy there. Whereas, I mean, James is pretty well suited to this character because he's an incredibly bright, thoughtful person. So he's very present on set and very thoughtful about his choices and about everything to, you know, the direction of the scene and the beats that should be there should not be there. I mean, he's incredibly intelligent, but he's not Alan. It's not like he has to stay in character. He's not to that degree, but.
And you're right. And I can see that they seem to be very similar. Although I think in an interview, he said that Alan Shore is closer to David E. Kelly than he is to James Spader.
Definitely. I haven't even met David E. Kelly, so I don't really know. But I would imagine closer to David E. Kelly.
Well, now you just dropped an interesting bomb. You have not even met, like you said, he's not on set when you're filming the scenes, but you haven't met him. Is he Mr. I'm staying away and letting my good guys run?
He's very hands-on. I mean, he's so aware of everything that goes on. I mean, he obviously writes so much of it. He sees dailies. He's so present, and he has the people that he trusts the most directing the episodes. He's not on set terribly often, you know, because he knows the people that are there he trusts, and so he does what he does brilliantly, which is, thank God, not on set monitoring our every take, but mm-hmm. sitting there writing the brilliant next episode.
Well, do you know, I don't know if you know this, but I mean, does he spend most of his time, you know, up in his home in Northern California, or does he, you know, hang out in LA while they're filming? And
I don't know. I think he's in Northern California more often than not, but yeah. Like I said, he's incredibly connected. I think you'd never even know he was not right in the office next door. He's so much a part of the comings and goings of every detail, casting and everything, and editing. And
sort of a nice balance between micromanagement and, you know, hands-off working independently.
Yeah, well, I think once you know you can trust the people that you have on set, like I said, I mean, we need him to write the dialogue. The writers are so amazing as well that he's hired. They're so smart people. But, you know, I think that he monologues like that. That's David E. Kelly working his magic.
Now, I'm curious about let's talk about just for a minute about the controversy over that particular closing. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that you'd kind of snuck on, looked at a message board post or two and kind of seen that there was a lot of talk about it.
Yeah.
But were you called back in? I mean, I was just curious. Do you think that the writers received or producers received any network notes that said, oh, you got to tone it down. We're going to, you know, get like slammed for this. We're going to lose our audience. Do you have to go back in and refilm some kind of
scenes? No, nothing. I mean, I don't know what happened prior to my, you know, getting the script and prior to us beginning the week of shooting. But, I mean, I certainly read it and was like, wow, this is going to be controversial.
Were there scenes that were, or I could say dialogue that were ended up cut that you thought maybe could have been cut for reasons that had to do with
I think it's pretty much in there.
Fabulous.
They did not mince words. And I think that's the part of the beauty of his show is that, you know, you just put it out there. You don't edit to please people because people like to have controversial topics and they like to fight about it. I mean, you go on the message boards, there's as many people who agree as disagree. And, mm-hmm. you know, the people who disagree, of course, there's always the people who say, like, why do you even watch it then? But they clearly watch it because they like to be observed thought-provoking things.
Exactly. It's not like this is his first episode of writing something about the government.
Right.
Yeah, it's totally in character. Those that are watching the episode don't know which way it's going to go. Certainly the judge, Shelley Berman, kind of went off on this tangent and predicted that he was going to have sentencing in this situation. So, you know, it was almost like he decided. But, yeah, we're going to find out what really happened. Here's the verdict.
Will the defendant please rise? Mr. Foreman, the jury has reached a unanimous verdict.
Yeah, Judge. Guilty.
wait till I ask you. Now, what say you?
Suspense is killing me.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Melissa Hughes, guilty as charged.
Ms. Hughes, the jury has found you guilty of federal income tax evasion.
Permission to be heard on sentencing, Judge.
Stop your hooting. I'm in no mood for any more of your jibber-jabber. The court fines Ms. Hughes $1,000 and sentences her to 30 days in prison, suspended. Adjourned.
30 days in prison?
Suspended, Melissa. Jibber Jabber gave you no jail time.
Oh. That's good.
It's very good.
Yay, where's Melissa going to find her $1,000?
I know. Oh, it'll be another episode.
I think Alan might step up on that. Any thoughts or memories of that final scene? Was it all filmed sort of in the whole day of shooting the courtroom?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. No, just that again, it's just written, I guess, to be in a way quite cute because she's sort of oblivious. You know, she's just young and is like, uh-oh, that sounds so bad. And then he's like, no, it's actually good.
That's good.
No, so, you know, just the, you know, playing kind of the, oh my God, I'm going to be in jail for a month.
I know.
And then the relief of finding out I'm not.
And the relief carries over into our final soundbite from the scene. This is Melissa doing the right thing. So sweet. You go to thank Alan for his passionate delivery.
Yes.
Passion is probably a good word for this soundbite. Well, I don't know. It was a very cute scene. It wasn't, you know, heavy-handed at all. And,
no, it was a pretty innocent kiss. But...
it was. You know, we're going to have to ask you a little bit about those takes. But,
okay.
You know, that's only to appease the Spader fans out there. All right, let's listen to how that storyline ended.
You're quite welcome.
Maybe we should celebrate over dinner.
Melissa, pay your taxes. That's about as far as you should go.
Of course, we're fading out slowly because there was just music for quite a while as the visuals were keeping us just mouth hanging open and watching the screen. It was very sweet. Why don't you fill us in on what the visual was happening while we just had some Danny Lux music there?
Well, that's when I lean in for the kiss and he tries to block me and then I go for it anyway. And it's funny, we did a few takes of the kissing and then Adam Arkin, our director, suggested that we do it with our eyes open, which is what they ended up using, which does have, weirdly, quite a provocative feel to it.
Interesting.
Because, I think two people with their eyes open kissing, it's almost like a power play in a weird way. Because, you know, after he says, like, I wouldn't go any further if I were you, and then I do it anyway, and then our eyes are open. And it definitely set a different tone, in my opinion.
Wow, how brilliant that they, you know, and I don't think I even noticed that. Oh, thank you for calling. I got to watch it now.
It did. It set a different tone even just doing it. And
did you find that, you know, personally, well, you said provocative, embarrassing in a sense? Or, you know, because most of us close our eyes.
You know? No, I don't. Almost the opposite of embarrassing. Almost like you're telling me this isn't okay and I'm going to show you that it is.
Ah, the
you know what I mean? And almost again, Melissa saying like, you don't see that I'm right, but I am right. And you'll see it someday.
Oh, this is good. You know, just to hark back. And again, you know, I can't take credit for this. This is one of those, I learned so much from the people that post on message boards, but Alan Shore keeps his eyes open during kisses. The interesting thing is that Melissa kept her eyes open.
And, oh, he always does. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Go back if you can and look for, you know, when he ended up first kissing Tara and other times. It's sort of a thing he's done. And I think he did it. I think he's done it in films. I think the discussion goes all the way back to him. So maybe it's a Spader thing. I don't
know. Interesting.
But good for you. And good for Adam for suggesting it.
It was. It was a really good suggestion because I think it plays well in light of the dialogue that immediately precedes it.
You walk in carrying a gift for him. Actually, uh-huh. It was, what was it?
An orchid.
Orchid. And there is some tie-in to the film secretary.
The secretary, right.
Now, that probably wasn't really discussed on set or in that context. It was just...
It was not discussed, although I'm sure many people, you know, I would say Spader fans certainly would would notice that.
Yeah,
if you want to go back to, like, the Georgia O'Keeffe floral orchid.
the sexual implications of an orchid.
Yeah, it could be read as a sexual invitation.
Oh, Melissa's into the subtlety.
Yeah, exactly.
Those read between the lines. Yeah, that's good. E. Edward Gray definitely had a thing for orchids, and maybe for the same reason, the Georgia O'Keeffe reason.
Yeah.
And I do believe, I couldn't really remember that, but again, I've been set correct on the message boards that it was maybe something that Gyllenhaal, the actress that brought her, brought him the orchid as well, an orchid. So, and we know how that ended.
We certainly do.
We have a few episodes maybe. I don't know you're going to say anything, but we'll see if any flirtation continues with Melissa and Alan.
I definitely know I continue to carry the torch.
Yes. Now, you did say deep into the pool, and I had to look up the Squid Pro Quo is the next to the last episode. Are you saying that you maybe got a script for that, too?
I am in that one as well, yes.
Hello. That's wonderful.
Yes.
Now, I've seen some sides. I haven't seen your part. So, I don't know. Can you tell us?
Interestingly, it's my first scene with anyone except Alan.
No.
I work with Julie Bowen.
Yes.
Which I'm thrilled about. I think it will be very funny.
Oh, now is it kind of a bigger scene or is it just
it's a small scene, but we, I never know how much I'm allowed to say, but there's a new girl in town and I'm not very happy about it. So I'm relaying some information to Julie Bowen about this girl.
Oh, now is she a new associate?
I don't know, and I'm not just being coy. Okay. I really don't know.
All right. Marlene Stranger?
Yes.
Yeah, I saw this in the slides.
Okay.
Well, I'm speculating. Who is this Marlene? She just comes in and horns in on a case that Denise is doing.
Yes, exactly.
And you're warning her.
Both of us, I think, have a little chip on our shoulder about this woman.
Okay. All right. Now, is it an Alan-related chip? I mean, is she sort
In my case, I think it is.
Because I noticed in the...
I think everything's Alan-related in my case.
Yeah, I know, exactly. There is this awkward moment that I didn't know what it meant where Alan and Marlene catch each other's eye and there's they look at each other for a minute. And I don't know if there's
and I think I'm a bit proprietary about him. And so
you should be. He's yours.
I start to worry that someone's, infringing upon my turf.
That's good. I'm so happy that you're going to be in there. And you haven't yet received any word or script yet for the season finale.
I don't know. No, okay. I don't know exactly what those two episodes are going to be.
All right. Wow. Any last thoughts on that storyline before we just quickly jump in through the other parts of the episode?
No, it was a real joy to do. It's nice to obviously have lines and be able to deliver dialogue that is so intelligent, but also so passionately stirring things up in our culture and everything. And, it's my favorite show on television.
Is it really?
Before, so it's done. It was before, I got the job. So it's an honor to be able to do it. So.
Oh, man, that's got to be. It's great when you're a fan. It's not just doing the job, just going through the lines.
Oh, it's the best.
That's great. Now, you mentioned that you haven't done, this Squid Pro Quo is going to be where you have a real substantial, a scene where you're actually dialoguing with other characters. But I think you've been in scenes with other characters. I know that Brad Chase in that very first Truly Madly Deeply was.
Yeah, been in scenes with other people, but my main dialogue, other than, with Hands, I definitely had some stuff with Hands, but, I've never had an interaction with Julie Bowen and I've been in scenes with Shirley, but they've been for 2 seconds. So this is actually like a scene. Alan's not even in the room.
And it's just the girls.
Julie, the two of us dishing.
The girls. You're listening to Boston Illegal Radio. This is Dana Greenlee. And we're finished with the first half of a two-parter of the review of the episode Stick It with Marisa Coughlin. We've just finished deconstructing the first storyline of three. That was the story that she was involved in with Alan Shore and the refusal to pay on principle her income tax. But Marisa is sticking with us for the second part. We'll be reviewing the storyline of Paul and Rachel and her efforts to face her substance abuse. We'll also look at Denise's storyline, the encounter she has with the dubious policeman, and of course the balcony scene. Marisa will be with us for discussion and insight on all of that. You don't want to miss her talking about each of the cast members in these other stories. She has a lot of insight to share on that. We'll also talk to her more in depth about her experiences off the Boston Legal set, what she's working on now, where she lives, how she spent her birthday. Definitely tune into part two. But we can never finish a Boston Legal podcast, even if it's just partly finished, without reminding you to tell all your friends to tune into Boston Legal on Tuesdays at 10 o'clock in the United States. Thank you for hanging in there with us as we conclude this part. The music of Amy Mann from the soundtrack to Magnolia, Wise Up, which was used in episode 16, Live Big.
It's far easier to fight for principles than to live up to them.
When you first began it.
I've never really stood up for anything. I know it sounds all stars and stripey, but my grandfather, he talked about the America he fought for. Now I want to fight for it.
You can hardly stand. But I know it's not going to stop.
It's unconstitutional for the United States to have a soul.
It's not going to stop.